The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
The Illustrated Man by Ray Bradbury. A calliope screamed, "Hey, the Illustrated Man!" And Mr. William Philippus Phelps stood, arms folded high on the summer night platform, a crowd unto himself. He was an entire civilization. In the main country, his chest, the vasties lived, nipple-eyed dragons swirling over his flesh pot, his almost feminine breasts. His navel was the mouth of a slit-eyed monster, an obscene, insucked mouth, toothless as a witch. And there were secret caves where darklings lurked, his armpits adripped with slow subterranean liquors, where the darklings, eyes jealously ablaze, peered out through rank creeper and hanging vine. Mr. William Philippus Phelps leered down from his freak platform with 1,000 peacock eyes. Across the sawdust meadow, he saw his wife, Lisbeth, far away, ripping tickets in half, staring at the silver belt buckle of passing men. Mr. William Philippus Phelps' hands were tattooed roses. At the sight of his wife's interest, the roses shriveled as with the passing of sunlight. A year before, when he had led Lisbeth to the marriage bureau to watch her work her name in ink slowly on the form, his skin had been pure and white and clean. He glanced down at himself in sudden horror. Now he was like a great painted canvas shaken in the night wind. How had it happened? Where had it all begun? It has started with the arguments, and then the flesh, and then the pictures. They had fought deep into the summer nights, she like a brass trumpet forever blaring at him, and he had gone out to eat 5,000 steaming hot dogs, 10 million up from her cosmetics table as he tore his shirt away. He stood in the naked bulb light of their car trailer, expanding his impossible chest. Here the Tremblies, half-maiden, half-goat, leaping when his biceps flexed. Here the country of lost souls, his chins, in so many accordion pleats of fat, numerous small scorpions, beetles, and mice were crushed, held, hid, darting into view, vanishing as he raised or lowered his chins. "My God," said Lisbeth, "my husband's a freak." She ran from the trailer and he was left alone to pose before the mirror. Why had he done it? To have a job, yes, but most of all to cover the fat that had larded itself impossibly over his bones. To hide the fat under a layer of color and fantasy. To hide it from his wife, but most of all, from himself. He thought of the old woman's last words. She had needled him 2 special tattoos, one on his chest, another for his back, which she would not let him see. She covered each with cloth and adhesive. "You are not to look at those 2, she had said. "Why?" "Later you may look. The future is in these pictures. You can't look now or it may spoil them. They are not quite finished. I put ink on your flesh and the sweat of your forms, the rest of the picture, the future, your sweat and your thought." Her empty mouth grinned. "Next Saturday night you may advertise. The big unveiling. Come see the Illustrated Man unveil his picture. You can make money in that way. You can charge admission to the unveiling, like to an art gallery. Tell them you have a picture that even you never have seen, that nobody has seen yet. the most unusual picture ever painted, almost alive, and it tells the future. Roll the drums and blow the trumpets, and you can stand there and smile at the big unveiling. That's a good idea, he said. But only unveil the picture on your chest, she said. That is first. You must save the picture on your back under the adhesive for the following week. Understand? How much do I owe you? Nothing, she said. If you walk with these pictures on you, I will be repaid with my own satisfaction. I will sit here for the next 2 weeks and think how clever my pictures are, for I make them fit each man himself and what is inside him. Now walk out of this house and never come back. Goodbye. Hey, the big unveiling. The red signs, blue in the night wind. No ordinary tattooed man. This one is illustrated, greater than Michelangelo. Tonight, admission, 10 cents. Now the hour had come. Saturday night, the crowd stirring their animal feet in the hot sawdust. In 1 minute, the carny boss pointed his cardboard megaphone. In the tent immediately to my rear, we will unveil the mysterious portrait upon the illustrated man's chest. Next Saturday night, the same hour, same location, we'll unveil the picture upon the illustrated man's back. Bring your friends. There was a stuttering roll of drums. Mr. William Philippus Phelps jumped back and vanished. The crowd poured into the tent, and once inside, found him reestablished upon another platform, the band brassing out a jig-time melody. He looked for his wife and saw her, lost in the crowd, like a stranger, come to watch a freakish thing, a look of contemptuous curiosity upon her face. For after all, he was her husband. This was a thing she didn't know about him herself. It gave him a feeling of great height and warmness and light to find himself the center of the jangling universe, the carnival world for one night. Even the other freaks, the skeleton, the seal boy, the yoga, the magician, and the balloon were scattered through the cloud. Ladies and gentlemen, the great moment. A trumpet flourish. A hum of drumsticks on tight cowhide. Mr. William Philippus Phelps let his cape fall. Dinosaurs, trolls, and half-woman, half-snakes writhed on his skin in the stark light. Ah, murmured the crowd, for surely there had never been a tattooed man like this. The beast eyes seemed to take red fire and blue fire, blinking and twisting. The roses on his fingers seemed to expel a sweet pink bouquet. The Tyrannosaurus Rex reared up along his leg, and the sound of the brass trumpet in the hot tent heavens was a prehistoric cry from the red monster throat. Mr. William Philippus Phelps was a museum jolted to life. Fish swam in seas of electric blue ink. Fountains sparkled under yellow suns. Ancient buildings stood in meadows of harvest wheat. Rockets burned across spaces of muscle and flesh. The slightest inhalation of his breath threatened to make chaos of the entire printed universe. He seemed a fire, the creatures flinching from the flame, drawing back from the great heat of his pride as he expanded under the audience's rapt contemplation. The carny boss held his fingers to the adhesive. The audience rushed forward, silent in the oven vastness of the night tent. You ain't seen nothing yet, cried the carny boss. The adhesive ripped free. There was an instant in which nothing happened, an instant in which the illustrated man thought that the unveiling was a terrible and irrevocable failure. But then the audience gave a low moan. The carny boss drew back, his eyes fixed, far out on the edge of the crowd. A woman, after a moment, began to cry, began to sob, and did not stop. Slowly, the illustrated man looked down at his naked chest and stomach. The thing that he saw made the roses on his hands discolor and die. All of his creatures seemed to wither, turn inward, shrivel with the arctic coldness that pumped from his heart outward to freeze and destroy them. He stood trembling. His hands floated up to touch that incredible picture, which lived, moved, and shivered with life. It was like gazing into a small room, seeing a thing of someone else's life, so intimate, so impossible, that one could not believe and one could not long stand to watch without turning away. It was a picture of his wife, Elizabeth, and himself, and he was killing her. Before the eyes of 1,000 people in a dark tent in the center of a black-forested Wisconsin land, he was killing his wife. His great flowered hands were upon her throat, and her face was turning dark, and he killed her, and he killed her, and did not ever in the next minute stop killing her. It was real. While the crowd watched, she died, and he turned very sick. He was about to fall straight down into the crowd. The tent whirled like a monster bat wing, flapping grotesquely. The last thing he heard was a woman sobbing far out on the shore of the silent crowd, and the crying woman was Elizabeth, his wife. In the night, his bed was moist with perspiration. The carnival sounds had melted away, and his wife, in her own bed, was quiet now, too. He fumbled with his chest. The adhesive was smooth. They had made him put it back. He had fainted. When he revived, the carny boss had yelled at him. "Why didn't you say what the picture was like?" "I didn't know. I didn't," said the illustrated man. "Good God," said the boss. "Scare hell out of everyone. Scared hell out of Lizzie. Scared hell out of me. Christ, where'd you get that damn tattoo?" He shuddered. "Apologize to Lizzie now." His wife stood over him. "I'm sorry, Elizabeth," he said weakly, his eyes closed. "I didn't know." "You did it on purpose," she said, "to scare me." "I'm sorry." "Either it goes or I go," she said. "Elizabeth, you heard me. That picture comes off or I quit this show." "Yeah, Phil," said the boss. "That's how it is." "Did you lose money? Did the crowd demand refunds?" "It ain't the money, Phil. For that matter, once the word got around, hundreds of people wanted in. But I'm running a clean show. That tattoo comes off. Was this your idea of a practical joke, Phil?" He turned in the warm bed. No, not a joke. Not a joke at all. He had been as terrified as anyone. Not a joke. That little old dust witch, what had she done to him, and how had she done it? Had she put the picture there? No, she had said that the picture was unfinished, and that he himself, with his thoughts and perspiration, would finish it. Well, he had done the job all right. But what, if anything, was the significance? He didn't want to kill anyone. He didn't want to kill Elizabeth. Why should such a silly picture burn here on his flesh in the dark? He crawled his fingers softly, cautiously down to touch the quivering place where the hidden portrait lay. He pressed tight, and the temperature of that spot was enormous. He could almost feel that little evil picture killing and killing and killing all through the night. "I don't wish to kill her," he thought insistently, looking over at her bed, and then 5 minutes later he whispered aloud, "Or do I?" "What?" she cried awake. "Nothing," he said after a pause. "Go to sleep." The man bent forward, a buzzing instrument in his hand. "This can take $5 an inch. Costs more to peel tattoos off than put 'em on. Okay. Jerk the adhesive." The illustrated man obeyed. The skin man sat back. Christ, no wonder you want that off. That's a ghastly. I don't even want to look at it. He flicked his machine. Ready? This won't hurt. The carny boss stood in the temp flat, watching. After 5 minutes, the skin man changed the instrument head, cursing. 10 minutes later, he scraped his chair back and scratched his head. Half an hour passed, and he got up, told Mr. Williams Phillips to dress, and packed his kit. Wait a minute, said the carny guy. You ain't done the job. And I ain't going to, said the skin man. I'm paying good money. What's wrong? Nothing, except that damn picture just won't come off. Damn thing must go right down to the bone. You're crazy. Mister, I'm in business 30 years and never seen a tattoo like this, an inch deep if it's anything. But I've got to get it off, cried the illustrated man. The skin man shook his head. Only one way to get rid of that. How? Take a knife and cut it off your chest. You won't live long, but the picture'll be gone. Come back here. But the skin man walked away. They could hear the big Sunday night crowd waiting. That's a big crowd, said the illustrated man. But they ain't going to see what they came to see, said the carny boss. You ain't going out there except with the adhesive. Hold still now. I'm curious about this other picture on your back. We might be able to give him an unveiling on this one instead. She said it wouldn't be ready for a week or so. The old woman said it would take time to set, to make a pattern. There was a soft ripping as the carny boss pulled aside a flap of white tape on the illustrated man's spine. What do you see? Gasped Mr. Phelps, bent over. The carny boss replaced the tape. Buster, as a tattooed man, you're a washout, ain't you? Why'd you let that old dame fix you up this way? I didn't know who she was. She sure cheated you on this one. No design to it, nothing, no picture at all. It'll come clear. You wait and see. The boss laughed. Okay, come on. We'll show the crowd part of you anyway. They walked out into an explosion of brassy music. He stood monstrous in the middle of the night, putting out his hands like a blind man to balance himself in a world now tilted, now rushing, now threatening to spin him over and down into the mirror before which he raised his hands. Upon the flat, dimly lighted tabletop were peroxide, acids, silver razors, and squares of sandpaper. He took each of them in turn. He soaked the vicious tattoo upon his chest. He scraped at it. He worked steadily for an hour. He was aware, suddenly, that someone stood in the trailer door behind him. It was 3 in the morning. There was a faint odor of beer. She had come home from town. He heard her slow breathing. He did not turn. Elizabeth, he said. You'd better get rid of it, she said, watching his hands move the sandpaper. She stepped into the trailer. I didn't want this picture this way, he said. You did, she said. You planned it. I didn't. I know you, she said. Oh, I know you hate me. Well, that's nothing. I hate you. I've hated you a long time now. Good God, when you started putting on the fat, you think anyone could love you then? I could teach you some things about hate. Why don't you ask me? Leave me alone, he said. In front of that crowd making a spectacle out of me. I didn't know what was under the tape. She walked around the table, hands fitted to her hips, talking to the beds. The walls, the table, talking it all out of her. And he thought, or did I know? Who made this picture, me or the witch? Who formed it? How? Do I really want her dead? And yet... He watched his wife draw nearer, nearer. He saw the ropey strings of her throat vibrate to her shouting. This and this and this was wrong with him. That and that and that was unspeakable about him. He was a liar, a schemer, a fat, lazy, ugly man, a child. Did he think he could compete with the carny boss or the tent peggers? Did he think he was sylphin and graceful? Did he think he was a framed El Greco? Da Vinci? Huh? Michelangelo? My eyes, she brayed. She showed her teeth. Well, you can't scare me into staying with someone I don't want touching me with their double slobby paws, she finished triumphantly. Lisbeth, he said. Don't Lisbeth me, she shrieked. I know your plan. You had that picture on to scare me. You thought I wouldn't dare leave you. Well, next Saturday night, the second unveiling, he said, you'll be proud of me. Proud? You're silly and pitiful. God, you're like a whale. You ever see a beached whale? I saw one when I was a kid. There it was, and they came and shot it. Some lifeguard shot it. Just a whale. Elizabeth, I'm leaving, that's all, and getting a divorce. Don't. And I'm marrying a man, not a fat woman. That's what you are. So much fat on you, there ain't no sex. You can't leave me, he said. Just watch. I love you, he said. Oh, she said, go look at your pictures. He reached out. Keep your hands off, she said. Elizabeth, don't come near. You turn my stomach. Lisbeth. All the eyes of his body seemed to fire, all the snakes to move, all the monsters to seethe, all the mouths to widen in rage. He moved toward her, not like a man, but a crowd. He felt the great bloodied reservoir of Orangade pump through his now, the sluice of cola and rich lemon pop pulse and sickening sweet sugar through his wrists, his legs, his heart, all of it, the oceans of mustard and relish and all the million drinks he had drowned himself in last year were a boil. His face was the color of a steamed beef, and the pink rose of his hands became those hungry, carnivorous flowers kept long years in tepid jungle and now let free to find their way on the night air before him. He gathered her to him like a great beast gathering in a struggling animal. It was a frantic gesture of love, quickening and demanding, which as she struggled, hardened to another thing. She beat and clawed at the picture on his chest. You've got to love me, Elizabeth. Let go, she screamed. She beat at the picture that burned under her fist. She slashed at it with her fingernails. Oh, Elizabeth, he said, his hands moving up her arms. I'll scream, she said, seeing his eyes. Elizabeth, the hands moved up to her shoulders, to her neck. Don't go away. Help, she screamed. The blood ran from the picture on his chest. He put his fingers about her neck and squeezed. She was a calliope cut in mid-shriek. Outside, the grass rustled. There was the sound of running feet. Mr. William Philippus Phelps opened the trailer door and stepped out. They were waiting for him. Skeleton, midget, balloon, yoga, Electra, Popeye, seal boy, the freaks waiting in the middle of the night in the dry grass. He walked toward them. He moved with a feeling that he must get away. These people would understand nothing. They were not thinking people. And because he did not flee, because he only walked, balanced, stunned between the tents, slowly, the freaks moved to let him pass. They watched him, because their watching guaranteed that he would not escape. He walked out across the black meadow, moths fluttering in his face. He walked steadily as long as he was visible, not knowing where he was going. They watched him go, and then they turned, and all of them shuffled to the silent car trailer together and pushed the door slowly wide. The illustrated man walked steadily in the dry meadow beyond the town. He went that way, a faint voice cried. Flashlights bobbled over the hills. There were dim shapes running. Mr. William Philippus Phelps waved to them. He was tired. He wanted only to be found now. He was tired of running away. He waved again. There he is, The flashlights changed direction. Come on, we'll get the bastard. When it was time, the illustrated man ran again. He was careful to run slowly. He deliberately fell down twice. Looking back, he saw the rest stakes they held in their hands. He ran toward a far crossroads lantern, where all the summer night seemed to gather. Merry-go-rounds of fireflies whirling, crickets moving their song toward that light, everything rushing as if by some midnight attraction toward that one high-hung lantern, the illustrated man first, the others close at his heels. As he reached the light and passed a few yards under and beyond, he did not need to look back. On the road ahead in silhouette, he saw the upraised tent stakes sweep violently up, up, and then down. A minute passed. In the country ravines, the crickets sang. The freaks stood over the sprawled illustrated man, holding their tent stakes loosely. Finally, they rolled him over on his stomach. Blood ran from his mouth. They ripped the adhesive from his back. They stared down for a long moment at the freshly revealed picture. Someone whispered. Someone swore softly. The thin man pushed back and walked away and was sick. Another and another of the freaks stared, their mouths trembling, and moved away, leaving the illustrated man on the deserted road, the blood running from his mouth. In the dim light, the unveiled illustration was easily seen. It showed a crowd of freaks bending over a dying fat man on a dark and lonely road, looking at a tattoo on his back, which illustrated a crowd of freaks bending over a dying fat man on a road. That was The Illustrated Man by Ray Bradbury. The next story is also by Ray. It's called The Dead Man. "That's the man right over there," said Mrs. Ribball, nodding across the street. "See that man perched on the tar barrel afore Mr. Jenkins' Odd Martin?" "Odd Martin, the one they say he's dead?" cried Arthur. Mrs. Ribball nodded. "Crazy as a weasel down a chimney. Carries on firm about how he's been dead since the flood and nobody appreciates." "I see him sitting there every day," cried Arthur. "Oh, yes, he sits there, he does. Sits there and stares at nothing. I say it's a crying shame they don't throw him in jail." Arthur made a face at the man. "Yeah. Never mind, he won't notice you. Most uncivil man I ever seen. Nothing pleased him." She yanked Arthur's arm. "Come on, sonny, we got shopping to do." They passed on up the street, past the barbershop. In the window, after they'd gone by, stood Mr. Simpson, snipping his blue shears and chewing his tasteless gum. He squinted thoughtfully out through the fly-speckled glass, looking at the man sitting over there on the tar barrel. "I figure the best thing could happen to Odd Martin would be to get married," he figured. His eyes glinted slyly. Over his shoulder, he looked at his manicurist, Ms. Weldon, who was busy burnishing the scraggly fingernails of a farmer named Gilpatrick. Miss Weldon, at this suggestion, did not look up. She had heard it often. They were always ragging her about Odd Martin. Mr. Simpson walked back and started work on Gilpatrick's dusty hair again. Gilpatrick chuckled softly. "What woman would marry Odd? Sometimes I almost believe he is dead. He's got an awful odor to him." Miss Weldon looked up into Mr. Gilpatrick's face and carefully cut his finger with one of her little scalpels. "God darn it, watch what you're doing, woman." Miss Weldon looked at him with calm little blue eyes and a small white face. Her hair was mouse brown. She wore no makeup and talked to no one most of the time. Mr. Simpson cackled and snicked his blue steel shears. Hope, hope, hope. He laughed like that. Miss Weldon, she knows what she's doing, Gilpatrick. You just be careful. Miss Weldon, she give a bottle of eau de cologne to Odd Martin last Christmas. It helped cover up his smell. Miss Weldon laid down her instruments. Sorry, Miss Weldon, apologized Mr. Simpson. I won't say no more. Reluctantly, she shook up her instruments again. Hey there, he goes again, cried one of the four other men waiting in the shop. Mr. Simpson whirled, almost taking Gilpatrick's pink ear with him in his shears. Come look, boys. Across the street, the sheriff stepped out of his office door just then, and he saw it happen, too. He saw what Odd Martin was doing. Everyone came running from all the little stores. The sheriff arrived and looked down into the gutter. Come now, Odd Martin. Come on now, he shouted. He poked down into the gutter with his shiny black boot tip. Come on, get up. You're not dead. You're good as me. You'll catch your death of cold there with all of them gum wrappers and cigar butts. Come on, get up. Mr. Simpson arrived on the scene and looked at Odd Martin lying there. He looks like a carton of milk. He's taken up valuable parking space for cars, this being Friday, whined the sheriff, and lots of people needing the area. Here now, Odd. Well, give me a hand here, boys. They laid the body on the sidewalk. Let him stay here, declared the sheriff, jostling around in his boots. Just let him stay until he gets tired of laying. He's done this a million times before. Likes the publicity. Get, you kids. He sent a bunch of children scuttling ahead of his cheek of tobacco. Back in the barber shop, Simpson looked around. Where's Miss Weldon? Oh, he looked through the glass. There she is, brushing him off again where he lies there. Fixing his coat, buttoning it up. Here she comes back. Don't nobody fun with her. She resents it. The barber clock said 12 o'clock, and then 1, and then 2, and then 3. Mr. Simpson kept track of it. I make you a bet that Odd Martin lies there till 4 o'clock, he said. Someone else said, I'll bet he's there until 4:30. Last time, a snickering of the shears, he was there 4 hours. Nice warm day today. He may nap there until 5. I'll say 5. Let's see your money, gents, or maybe later. The money was collected and put on a shelf by the hair ointments. One of the younger men began shaving a stick with his pocket knife. It's sort of funny how we joke about Odd. We're scared of him inside. I mean, we won't let ourselves believe he's really dead. We don't dare believe it. We'd never get over it if we knew. So we make him a joke. We let him lie around. He don't hurt nobody. He's just there. But I notice Doc Hudson has never really touched Odd's heart with his stethoscope. Scared of what he'd find, I bet. Scared of what he'd find. Laughter. Simpson laughed and swished his shears. Two men with crusty beards laughed a little too loud. The laughter didn't last long. Great one for joking, you are, they all said, slapping their gaunt knees. Miss Weldon, she went on manicuring her client. He's getting up. There was a general scramble to the plate glass window to watch old Martin gain his feet. He's up on one knee, now up on the other. Now someone's giving him a hand. It's Miss Weldon. She sure got over there in a rush. What time is it? 5 o'clock. Pay me, boys. That Miss Weldon's a queer nut herself, taken after an old man like Odd. Simpson clicked his scissors. Being an orphan, she's got quiet ways. She likes men who don't say much. Odd, he don't say hardly anything. Just the opposite of us crude men, eh, fellows? We talk too much. Miss Weldon don't like our way of talking. There they go, the two of them, Miss Weldon and Odd Martin. Say, take a little more off around my ears, will you, simp? Skipping down the street, bouncing a red rubber ball, came little Charlie Bellows, his blonde hair flopping and a yellow fringe over his blue eyes. He bounced the ball abstractedly, tongue between lips, and the ball fell under old Odd Martin's feet where he sat once more on the tar barrel. Inside the grocery, Miss Weldon was doing her supper shopping, putting soup cans and vegetable cans into a basket. "Can I have my ball?" asked little Charlie Bellows upward at the 6 feet, 2 inches of Odd Martin. No one was within hearing distance. "Can you have your ball?" said Odd Martin haltingly. He turned it over inside his head, it appeared. His level gray eyes shaped up Charlie like one would shape up a little ball of clay. "You can have your ball, yes, take it." Charlie bent slowly and took hold of the bright red rubber globe and rose slowly, a secretive look in his eyes. He looked north and south, then up at Odd's bony, pale brown face. "I know something." Odd Martin looked down. "You know something?" Charlie leaned forward. "You're dead." Odd Martin sat there. "You're really dead," whispered little Charlie Bellows. "But I'm the only one who really knows. I believe you, Mr. Odd. I tried it once myself. Dying, I mean. It's hard. It's work. I laid on the floor for an hour, but I blinked and my stomach itched, so I scratched it. Then I quit." "Why?" He looked at his shoes. "'Cause I had to go to the bathroom." A slow, understanding smile formed in the soft, pallid flesh of Odd Martin's long, bony face. "It is work. It isn't easy." "Sometimes I think about you," said Charlie. "I see you walking by my house at night, sometimes at 2 in the morning, sometimes at 4. I wake up and I know you're out walking around. I know I should look out, and I do, and gee, there you are, walking and walking, not going hardly any place." "There's no place to go," Odd said, with his large, square, calloused hands on his knees. "I try thinking of some place to go." He slowed like a horse to a pit bull. "But it's hard to think. I try and try. Sometimes I almost know what to do, where to go, then I forget. Once I had an idea to go to a doctor and have him declare me dead, but somehow," his voice was slow and husky and low, "I never got there." Charlie looked straight at him. "If you want, I'll take you." Odd Martin looked leisurely at the setting sun. "No, I'm weary, tired, but I'll wait. Now I've gone this far, I'm curious to see what happens next. After the flood that washed away my farm and all my stock and put me under water like a chicken in a bucket, I filled up like you did fill a thermos with water, and I came walking out of the flood anyhow. But I knew I was dead. Late of nights I lay listening in my room, but there's no heartbeat in my ears or in my chest or in my wrists, though I lie as still as a cold cricket. Nothing inside me but a darkness and a relaxation and an understanding. There must be a reason for me still walking, though. Maybe it was because I was still young when I died. Only 28, not married yet. I always wanted to marry, never got around to it. Here I am doing odd jobs around town, saving my money, 'cause I never eat. Heck, I can't eat. And sometimes getting so discouraged and downright bewildered that I lie down in the gutter and hope they'll take me and poke me in a pine box and lay me away forever. Yet at the same time, I don't want that. I want a little more. I know that whenever Miss Weldon walks by and I see the wind playing her hair like a little brown feather." He sighed away into silence. Charlie Bellows waited politely a minute, then cleared his throat and darted away, bouncing his ball. See you later. Odd stared at the spot where Charlie'd been. 5 minutes later, he blinked. Eh? Somebody here? Somebody speak? Miss Weldon came out of the grocery with a basket full of food. Would you like to walk me home, Odd? They walked along in an easy silence, she careful not to walk too fast because he set his legs down carefully. The wind rustled in the cedars and in the elms and the maples all along the way. Several times his lips parted and he glanced aside at her, and then he shut his mouth tight and stared ahead as if looking at something a million miles away. Finally he said, Miss Weldon? Yes, Odd? I've been saving and saving up my money. I've got quite a handsome sum. I don't spend much for anything, and you'd be surprised, he said sincerely. I got about $1,000, maybe more. Sometimes I count it and get tired, and I can't count no more. And he seemed baffled and a little angry with her suddenly. Why do you like me, Miss Weldon? He demanded. She looked a little surprised and smiled up at him. It was almost a childlike look of liking she gave him. Because you're quiet. Because you're not loud and mean like the men at the barber shop. Because I'm lonely and you've been kind. Because you're the first one that ever liked me. The others don't even look at me once. They say I can't think. They say I'm a moron because I didn't finish the sixth grade. But I'm so lonely, Odd. And talking to you means so much. He held her small white hand tight. She moistened her lips. I wish we could do something about the way people talk about you. I don't want to sound mean, but if you'd only stop telling them you're dead, Odd. He stopped walking. Then you don't believe me either, he said remotely. You're dead for want of a good woman's cooking, for loving, for living right, Odd. That's what you mean by dead, nothing else. His gray eyes were deep and lost. Is that what I mean? He saw her eager, shiny face. Yes, that's what I mean. You guessed it right. That's what I mean. Their footsteps went alone together, drifting in the wind like leaves floating, and the night got darker and softer, and the stars came out. Two boys and two girls stood under a street lamp about 9 o'clock that evening. Far away down the street, someone walked along slowly, quietly alone. There he is, said one of the boys. You ask him, Tom. Tom squalled uneasily. The girls laughed at him. Tom said, Oh, okay, but you come along. The wind flung the trees right and left, shaking down leaves and singles and clusters that fell past Odd Martin's head as he approached. Mr. Odd? Hey there, Mr. Odd. Eh? Oh, hello. We, gulped Tom, looking around for assistance. We want to know if, well, we want you to come to our party. A minute later, after looking at Tom's clean, soap-smelling face and seeing the pretty blue jacket his 16-year-old girlfriend wore, Odd Martin answered, Thank you, but I don't know. I might forget to come. No, you wouldn't, but Sister Tom, you'd remember this one because it's Halloween. One of the girls yanked Tom's arm in his. Let's not, Tom, let's not, please. He won't do, Tom. He isn't scary enough. Tom shook her off. Let me handle this. The girl pleaded. Please, no, he's just a dirty old man. Bill can put cattle tallow on his fingers and those horrible porcelain teeth in his mouth and the green chalk marks under his eyes and scare the ducks out of us. We don't need him. And she jerked her rebellious head at Odd. Odd Martin stood there. He heard the wind in the high treetops for 10 minutes before he knew that the four young people were gone. A small dry laugh came up in his mouth like a pebble. Children. Halloween. Not scary enough. Bill would do better. Just an old man. He tasted the laughter and found it both strange and bitter. The next morning, little Charlie Bellows flung his ball against the stone front, retrieving it, flung it again. He heard someone humming behind him, turned. "Oh, hello, Mr. Odd." Odd Martin was walking along with green paper dollars in his fingers, counting it. He stopped suddenly. His eyes were blank. "Charlie," he cried out. "Charlie." His hands groped. "Yes, sir, Mr. Odd." "Charlie, where was I going? Where was I going? Going somewhere to buy something for Miss Weldon. Here, Charlie, help me." "Yes, sir, Mr. Odd." Charlie ran up and stood in his shadow. A hand came down, money in it, $70 of money. "Charlie, run by address for Miss Weldon." His mind was gasping, grasping, clutching, seizing, wrestling in a web of forgetfulness. There was a stark terror and longing and fear in his face. "I can't remember the place. Oh, God, help me remember. A dress and a coat for Miss Weldon at Crossmere's department store," said Charlie helpfully. "No, Fieldman's, no, Mr. Lieberman's, no, Lieberman, that's it, Lieberman, Lieberman, here, here, Charlie, here, run down to Lieberman's and get a new green dress for Miss Weldon and a new coat, a new green dress with yellow roses painted on it. You get them and bring them to me here. Oh, Charlie, wait." "Yes, sir, Mr. Odd." "Charlie, you think maybe I could clean up at your house?" asked Odd quietly. "I need a bath." "Gee, I don't know, Mr. Odd. My folks are funny. I don't know." "That's all right, Charlie. I understand. Run now." Charlie ran on the double, clutching the money. He ran by the barber shop. He poked his head in. Mr. Simpson stopped snipping on Mr. Trumbull's hair and glared at him. "Hey," cried Charlie. "Odd Martin's humming a tune." "What tune?" asked Mr. Simpson. "It goes like this," said Charlie, and hummed it. "Ye gods almighty," bellowed Simpson. "So that's why Miss Weldon ain't here manicuring this morning. That there's tune's the wedding march." Charlie ran on, pandemonium. Shouting, laughter, the sound of water squishing and pattering, the back of the barber shop steamed. They took turns. First, Mr. Simpson got a bucket of hot water and tossed it down in a flap over old Martin. Over Odd Martin, who sat in the tub saying nothing, just sitting there. And then Mr. Trumbull scrubbed old Martin's pale back, Odd Martin's pale back, with a big brush and lots of cow soap. And every once in a while, Shorty Phillips doused Odd with a jigger of eau de cologne. They all laughed and ran around in the stream. "Getting married, huh, Odd? Congratulations, boy. More water." "I always said that's what you needed," laughed Mr. Simpson, hitting Odd in the chest with a bunch of cold water this time. Old Martin pretended not to even notice the shock. "You'll smell better now." Odd sat there. "Thanks. Thanks so very much for doing this. Thanks for helping me. Thanks for giving me a bath this way. I needed it." Simpson laughed behind his hand. "Sure thing, anything for you, Odd," someone whispered in the steamy background. "Imagine her and him married, a moron married to an idiot," Simpson frowned. "Shut up back there." Charlie rushed in. "Here's the green dress, Mr. Odd." An hour later, they had Odd in the barber chair. Someone had lent him a new pair of shoes. Mr. Trumbull was polishing them vigorously, winking at everybody. Mr. Simpson snipped Odd's hair for him, would not take money for it. "No, no, Odd, you keep that as a wedding present from me to you. Yes, sir," and he spat. Then he shook some rose water all over Odd's dark hair. "There, moonlight and roses." Martin looked around. "You won't tell anybody about this marriage," he asked, "until tomorrow? Me and Miss Weldon sort of want a marriage without the town poking fun, you understand?" "Why, sure, sure, Odd," said Simpson, finishing the job. "Mum's the word. Where are you going to live? You buying a new farm?" "Farm?" Odd Martin stepped down from the chair. Somebody lent him a nice new coat, and someone else had pressed his pants for him. He looked fine. Yes, I'm going to buy the property now. Have to pay extra for it, but it's worth it. Extra. Come along now, Charlie Bellows. He went to the door. I bought a house out on the edge of town. I have to go make the payments on it now. Come on, Charlie. Simpson stopped him. What's it like? You didn't have much money. You couldn't afford much. No, said I. You're right. It's a small house, but it'll do. Some folks built it a while back, then moved away east somewheres. It was up for sale for only $500, so I got it. Miss Weldon and I are moving out there tonight after our marriage, but don't tell nobody, please, until tomorrow. Sure thing, Odd, sure thing. Odd went away into the 4 o'clock light, Charlie at his side, and the men in the barber shop went, sat down, laughing. The wind sighed outside, and slowly the sun went down, and the snipping of the shears went on, and the men sat around, laughing and talking. The next morning at breakfast, little Charlie Bellow sat thoughtfully spooning his cereal. Father folded his newspaper across the table and looked at Mother. Everybody in town's talking about the quiet elopement of Odd Martin and Miss Weldon, said Father. People looking for them can't find them. Well, said Mother, I hear he bought a house for her. I heard that too, said Father. I phoned Carl Rogers this morning. He says he didn't sell any house to Odd, and Carl is the only real estate dealer in town. Charlie Bellows swallowed some cereal. He looked at his father. Oh, no, he's not the only real estate dealer in town. What do you mean? Demanded Father. Nothing, except that I looked out the window at midnight and I saw something. You saw what? It was all moonlight. And you know what I saw? Well, I saw two people walking up the Elm Grade Road, a man and a woman, a man in a new dark coat and a woman in a green dress, walking real slow, holding hands. Charlie took a breath. And the two people were Mr. Odd Martin and Miss Weldon. And walking out on the Elm Grade Road, there ain't any houses out there way at all. Only the Trinity Park Cemetery and Mr. Gustafson's in town. He sells tombs in the Trinity Park Cemetery. He's got an office in town. Like I said, Mr. Carl Rogers ain't the only real estate man in town. So, oh, snorted Father irritably, you were dreaming? Charlie bent his head over his cereal and looked out from the corners of his eyes. Yes, sir, he said finally, sighing. I was only dreaming.